It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk Colbert. Good morning again, Casey.
Morning, Kirk. I don't know if you engaged in this activity as a young child, but there's a bill out there to... No, it's not as bad as you think. To criminalize co-sleeping, where children sleep with their parents, with their mother or their father.
Right.
And this bill would make it a crime if an infant is injured or dies as a result of sleeping with a parent who's legally intoxicated or substantially impaired by drugs or alcohol. Now, when you read the text of this bill, it's very boring and I won't bore the audience with the details, but basically this bill would criminalize if you have a BAC of 0.08 or more, or you have substantial impaired physical or mental functioning as a result of taking drugs or alcohol or a restricted controlled substance. So that could be even a prescribed substance that's legally prescribed by a doctor. So it would make it a felony if you cause bodily harm, and a class H felony if you cause bodily harm, a class F felony if you cause great bodily harm, and a class D felony, which is a higher level of felony, if you cause death. There are critics to this bill, and this would basically apply to infants, so babies that are 12 months or less, you know,
right,
from birth to 12 months. And the reasons for engaging in co-sleeping are many, but some include it can provide for convenient breastfeeding, it can help an infant sleep, it can help the mother get sleep, and if there's no crib available, a lot of times in poorer neighborhoods, you may have a higher rate of co-sleeping. So, and to me, it would be difficult to prove, I would think, that a felony occurred in many situations. However, prosecutors do have, and they call it the tools in their tool belt. This is actually what I think one of the representatives who introduced this bill said: we need another tool in the tool belt to the prosecution, as if there's not enough tools.
They have a hammer.
Right.
And a stapler.
So this would be another one. Now, there's
some duct tape.
There would not need to be any evidence under this bill of any reckless behavior. Now, we already have crimes such as reckless homicide that can be charged and have been charged in certain circumstances. But representatives and supporters of this bill say we need more than that, and you shouldn't have to prove essentially recklessness in order to get a conviction. It's enough if somebody is intoxicated, they know they're intoxicated, they go to sleep, they're co-sleeping in a bed or another surface with their baby, and they kill them or injure the baby.
Well, it's a little confusing to me because, first of all, isn't it the same thing as a reckless homicide, which is actually, I presume, a more serious crime? Because if someone engages in reckless activities such as being so intoxicated that you can't care for your child and you end up sleeping on top of your child or whatever the case may be, you know, it seems like there's an overlap here. But in addition to that, how on earth is this going to be enforced? You know how impairment is typically proven? There are two separate ways. One is through a blood test. Another is by administering field sobriety tests. And if we're talking about either impairment by alcohol or by some form of medication or drugs or whatever the case may be, how on earth is this going to come up? You know, the mother wakes up in the morning. The child is not alive anymore. She calls the police, and then they have to retrace the steps to figure out, you know, what do they do? Give her field sobriety tests?
Yeah, when
right
she was
then
sleeping.
And there?
Well, no, I think it would be – I don't even think they'd need that. I think they could just get blood, presumably.
Presumably.
If they have a warrant. And if
Then they got to get a warrant. But who's going to establish when the child died? Because if the person's out of it –
Right, right.
I mean, it just seems like an odd thing. Now, on the one hand, I – fully understand and can appreciate the need to educate the public on the risks of co-sleeping. Now, that being said, it's something that's been done for thousands and thousands of years, you know, and one might argue that perhaps we didn't have the same prevalence in our society that we have nowadays with regard to consumption of alcohol or consumption of illegal drugs or whatever the case may be. But I suppose that's debatable, you know.
I
because
think it is debatable.
We've had those substances in existence for almost as long as we've had people. And the fact that historically a child sleeps with his or her mother, at least, you know, going back to however long in history you want to think back to, doesn't it seem that we're interfering a little bit with, not only the family structure here, but as you've mentioned, there are economic implications here as well.
Well, and there are already tools in the tool belt to prosecute these cases. Think about negligent homicide. I mean, that's just one example, but there are, I think, 9 different versions of or types of homicide that can be charged currently in the Wisconsin statutes. And so when we look at this kind of thing, we have to think about it, I think, in terms of it's sort of like the just say no, right? I mean, we're saying just don't co-sleep. That's the example.
Well, and,
don't do that.
And what we're trying to do here is we're actually trying to encourage mothers to not co-sleep at all.
Right. That's the point, even when you're sober.
Right.
And that's what some doctors will point to, and they'll say, one of these doctors that was cited in the article says, you know, this is sending the wrong message, because this is sending the message that it's okay to co-sleep if you're sober, and it's not if you're impaired by alcohol or drugs.
Well, I don't know if I agree with that, because I see the point.
Right, but the
I see where
okay
a doctor
anything,
I see where a doctor would come into play and say, look, the message this sends is, you know, just don't do it when you're drunk. But anyway, the point is that I can see where that point would come from, but at the same time, and here's where I think we should be emphasizing our and utilizing our community resources. We have programs in place to help mothers with the process of properly raising their children. We have education programs. We have social workers. We have hospital personnel that are part of that process. And that's the key. The key here is to make sure that young mothers are aware of the risks and dangers associated with co-sleeping. And to have this criminal law out there that gives, you know, another tool in the tool belt, as we've already said, for prosecuting somebody, I think is counterproductive. I think it's ludicrous, actually, that we would have something that criminalizes such a narrow category of behavior. And we're creating problems that relate on a much bigger level. And let me explain what I mean by that. I was referring previously to the method of enforcement or the method of investigation. A family has just gone through a tragedy of losing an infant child, and suddenly it becomes a criminal investigation. Some might say, hey, there's nothing wrong with that. If the person committed a crime, so be it. But when it comes to, think about the implications. The police arrive. Now there's a criminal investigation. It involves figuring out what the person drank or what the person consumed, interrogating that mother, reconstructing the scene, reconstructing the time frame, getting a warrant, getting a blood test, and all these other things when, you know, and think about the privacy of your home, the fact that the sanctity of your castle, so to speak, no matter how big or small it is something that is implicated greatly in this.
Well,
it'd be like saying that the police have the authority to come in your house anytime, anywhere, to investigate a drunk driving incident or something like that without having probable cause.
Well, I wonder how this is going to work. And I would just play devil's advocate for a second and say that if a mother or a father is behaving extremely irresponsibly, and let's say they're getting drunk every night and going to sleep with their kid, and they're doing this over and over again, that obviously creates a risk and a danger. So I can understand why you would want some prosecutions here. On the other hand, Representative Kirkman, who is one of the women who introduced this bill, and I quote from her, she says, a lot of times the facts show that there was intent to harm a child. And she's talking about in co-sleeping cases. I have not seen one co-sleeping case where a mother or father has the intent to roll over onto their child and kill the child.
Well, that would be an intentional homicide.
Right. Exactly. And what I'm saying is, I don't see any evidence of that happening. Okay, there were 15.
I suppose it could happen.
I suppose it could, but there were 15 this year in Milwaukee County of co-sleeping deaths. So that's really where this is focused. Out of all those 15, I don't know of one example that I've been able to see where there was any evidence of any intent on the part of the parent.
Might
have been negligence. I don't know. I don't know what she's talking about. But it's one of these things where I think if we have this thing where we say just don't do it, versus we've got all these studies that say anywhere between 70% and 80% of parents do co-sleep at some point with their kids. Would it not be more useful to say, don't do it under these circumstances, but if you're going to do it when you're sober, make sure that you do these types of things. Like, don't use loose bedding, don't sleep on soft surfaces, It's actually very dangerous for, and I know this is going to sound bad, but it's more dangerous for obese people to sleep with their children than it is for people who are not obese. There are all kinds of things that we can educate the public on, but rather we take this approach that just say no. I mean, it's like the war on alcohol and drugs, right? Just say no, we know, doesn't work. We know that from studies that it doesn't work, and it hasn't worked. And so that's the same approach that we're taking in this. Plus, the difficult circumstances you point out, Kirk, of trying to relate back, unless somebody is intoxicated out of their mind at the time that you stick the needle into their arm and take their blood, how are you ever going to be able to prove that at the time that they were a 0.08 or above or impaired by alcohol or other drugs? I mean, I think it's just going to be a difficult scenario. So we do have to take a break. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
Kirk, have you ever heard of the affluenza defense? Not influenza, but affluenza.
No, I haven't.
This is very interesting.
I'm writing this down.
You are. And this is something where, let me just explain the backstory. This was a case in Texas where a 16-year-old named Ethan Couch crashed into four people who had pulled over to assist a stranded driver in June. It was a quadruple OWI homicide. Four people died. He was going estimated 70 miles per hour in a 40-mile-per-hour zone. His BAC was 0.24, three times the legal limit. And Couch and his friends had allegedly stolen beer from a Walmart. Okay. Now, Couch, you have to remember, comes from an extremely wealthy family, an affluent family. His two friends were ejected from the vehicle. One was paralyzed. Again, four people died. He admitted to driving drunk. Tests also revealed traces of Valium in his system. And he was just sentenced. Prosecutors were asking, a 16-year-old, by the way, so he's in adult court.
Right.
And we've talked about the controversy about juveniles being tried in adult court. Prosecutors were asking for 20 years prison. Couch's defense lawyers were asking for probation. The judge ended up giving him 10 years of probation. And so this has caused outrage. And the reason that the judge gave it, at least in part, seems to be, from all the articles that I read, because this was a boy who was brought up in a home by parents who never taught him responsibility, by parents who let him do, essentially, we're permissive parents. They let him do whatever he wanted to and didn't impose any sort of strict guidelines or responsibility.
So maybe the parents should go to prison.
Well, that's part of the controversy here. Now, they had a psychologist testify at the sentencing hearing, and he said, and I quote, "The teen never learned to say that you're sorry if you hurt someone. If you hurt someone, you sent him money." Now, during the defense argument, they said that the parents would be willing to pay $450,000 for this teen's intensive inpatient rehabilitation if he were to get probation. And the judge also ordered him to do mandatory inpatient rehabilitation. It's going to cost about $450,000. Now, the state doesn't have to pay for any of that. DOC doesn't. The parents are going to pay for it. So the question becomes, in this case, and they called it an affluenza defense. I mean, I don't think the defense lawyers did, but it's being referred to that. The inability to make good decisions thanks to a lifetime of coddling. Okay? And so the concern that I have here, and I have many concerns, and I'm not one to criticize oftentimes judges for doing what appears to the public to be a quote-unquote lenient sentence, because I think, as we've demonstrated in this country, we have harsher sentences than many other countries around the world, and we incarcerate more people than any other country on earth by far. So when it comes to harsh sentences or lenient sentences, I'm reluctant to criticize them. However, I will say this. This is a situation where this boy seemed to benefit, and he is a boy, from his parents being rich. And that's a problem when it comes to all being treated equal under the law. Because in most situations, most parents cannot afford to fork over $450,000 out of pocket to pay for somebody's rehab. And so the question becomes, did that play a part? It certainly played a part in, I believe, the judge saying, you know, this guy was brought up in a wealthy family, he didn't have a lot of responsibility, didn't have anything to care for. Shouldn't the focus more be on the fact that the boy was 16? And yes, he may know right from wrong, but there are a bunch of problems here. Was he treated differently? And would somebody who is similarly situated, where they have they don't have those resources, would they be given the same type of sentence as this boy got?
Well, I think that you hit on a very important problem here, and that is the disparity of treatment between those that have and those that have not. And clearly, there appears to be a message here that's being sent that if you can fork over a bunch of money, hire some fancy lawyers, which I'm sure that was part of this, and if you can go in and offer a ransom for you know, your child's own freedom, I suppose that those sorts of things, unfortunately, do make a difference. I mean, that's what we're hearing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, let me just play devil's advocate for a second here. The publicity that this case is obtaining as a result of what appears to be a disparity, or what we can identify as what may seem to be unfair, also will highlight the fact that it is an incident that has caused a great deal of concern within the community, and that treatment is something that is very important. I think this would also highlight the fact that if someone's going to obtain significant and meaningful treatment, it's supposed to cost a lot of money. And this is a service that we're not providing to poor people.
Right.
And, you know, so some good can come out of this. And the fact that, you know, it really just highlights the fact that if the judge agreed that that is something that would help this young man as a result of whatever sort of upbringing he may have had. And we can draw an analogy here. Let's say, okay, in this situation, he was coddled. In this situation, he was not taught responsibility. He was allowed to do all kinds of things. Let's compare that to a situation where a family is extremely poor and probably a single parent, let's just use this as a hypothetical, who's working several jobs in a situation with many children to care for and is struggling with meeting those responsibilities. And as a result of that, there is a lesser amount of supervision. You see the analogy here.
Right.
Now, if there were sufficient community resources that were devoted toward having meaningful and significant treatment in the context of making sure that someone is appropriately educated, appropriately dealt with, so that this sort of thing never happens again. You know, in a way, I think the judge has implemented a form of restorative justice in this whole thing. So on its surface, I agree with you that, you know, there is this tremendous disparity. But on the other hand, I think the judge is identifying the fact that the most important thing that we can do to address this problem is education and treatment. And it just so happens that this individual has access to the best. The thing that upsets me so greatly about all of this is that we don't have those same resources devoted to people that can't afford it.
Well, and I don't like to compare and contrast because every case is different, but I just want to point to a case that happened in Wisconsin. I believe it was in Washington County. There was a defendant who on Christmas Eve of 2012, he had a car accident, crossed the center line, hit a vehicle head-on. He was allegedly going between 65 and 80 miles per hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone. He was eventually arrested for drunk driving. One person, I believe, died. He was sentenced this week or this past week to 28 years of initial confinement or total sentence of 28 years initial confinement and 15 years of extended supervision. You know, now, I did go on CCAP, and it looks like, at least according to CCAP, he has a fairly lengthy record. He is significantly older than the 16-year-old, and the facts and circumstances of the case are different. But my point is, I wonder whether that individual also needs treatment and whether he's ever been given that opportunity in the past. In other words, now we have a situation in Texas where somebody can afford the best possible treatment available. And good for the judge for recognizing that treatment is should play a huge part in this. I mean, good for the judge for recognizing that. Most people do. Most medical doctors do. But is that same benefit being given to others? And I think that's the biggest problem. I mean,
I can reconcile these two cases in my mind. I mean, it makes sense to me. A 16-year-old that – and put aside the fact that apparently the kid had a privileged upbringing. Just look at any 16-year-old and the human development that one goes through. And sure, we have to recognize that a 16-year-old is not as much on notice as an adult in their later years. And he hasn't had the opportunity to make as many poor choices as right. this other individual that went away for 28 years. You know, and I'll tell you something else, Casey. The kid that's going to be on probation for 10 years in Texas is going to have 10 years worth of enforced sobriety, enforced inpatient heavy-duty treatment that will not be fun, okay? You know, I know prison's not supposed to be fun either, but I give kudos to this judge for recognizing that the problem is much greater than just sending somebody
locking
to prison.
Somebody up, right.
Because the problem, and we're not talking about, you know, the traditional method of homicide that we're used to, where you buy a gun, you hunt down somebody, and you shoot them with intent. We're talking about making poor decisions because our society places too much of a not emphasis, I'll say. It does not emphasize enough the risks associated with drinking alone. We have all kinds of laws out there and all kinds of headlines that we can draw from that will tell the public that drinking and driving is dangerous. But what about drinking? What about a 16-year-old drinking? And, you know, it does come into play that the parents were not enforcing the rules, whether they be their own rules or the rules of society, well enough in this situation. So maybe, you know, this 16-year-old shouldn't go to prison for 20 years. I can see that. I can right. absolutely see
that. No, I can see that too, and I agree. But this also brings to mind the age-old argument about children being treated in adult court. This 16-year-old's emotions and his upbringing aside, most 16-year-olds, maybe all 16-year-olds, they do not have fully developed brains. And while you can argue, well, yeah, he knew it wasn't right to get in the car and drink and drive. That's probably true.
Yeah,
however, his level of responsibility and his level of mature thinking is certainly less than a 28-year-old.
Unfortunately, I've represented many people that are facing drunk driving homicide charges, and I've never met a single person that intended to kill another person. And it's always a tragedy. It's always a horrible thing. And it all comes down to a decision that is made so often in our society where someone feels that they're okay to drive, and people make that decision every single day, every single night in our state and in every state. And they feel that it's okay. So the decision that they're making is a wrong one, but it's not the same wrongfulness that we attribute to something intentional.
We'll talk about next a 6-year-old who was accused of sexual harassment when we continue Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
All right, welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
I'm Kirk Colbert. That was a great commercial break. I enjoyed every one of those commercials.
Absolutely. Well, Kirk, a 6-year-old boy has been accused of sexual harassment. You might think, how could this have happened? Well, a Colorado first grader was suspended because he kissed a girl in the class on the hand.
On the hand?
The boy was accused of sexually harassing the girl. The boy apparently had a crush on the girl and kissed her hand during reading group.
Mm-hmm.
The school decided to suspend the boy for 2 days. There was no force or coercion that was involved. And in terms of past problems, this boy apparently was also suspended for roughhousing at one point and was also accused of kissing the same girl on the cheek at one point. So this caused an uproar because he was suspended, and the school has a zero tolerance policy that you are going to be labeled.
Whatever that means.
Yeah, a sexual harasser if you do anything that could be perceived as sexual. I don't know what their definition is.
How do they explain that to a 6-year-old?
We
have a zero tolerance policy, Mr. 6-year-old.
It's a good point because the son, apparently after this incident, after he was suspended, was asking questions of his mother, "Mommy, what is sex?" He was asking questions of her. What is sex? He didn't even know what it is. So you can imagine if he doesn't know what sex is, he doesn't know what sexual harassment is.
Right.
And so, I mean, many of our politicians don't even know what sexual harassment is.
or at least they're not aware of that they're doing it.
They're not aware that they're doing it, yes. So as an update to this story, it just recently came out, I believe it was on Thursday, that as a result of the negative publicity that this generated and the outrage that this generated throughout the community, The school system says it will no longer classify the boy in his disciplinary file as having sexually harassed this girl, but rather his actions will now be labeled misconduct.
Oh, that's way better.
So it's essentially general misconduct.
Forget about the fact that we're talking about him now on the radio in Wisconsin, and this happened in Colorado, and you know, 20 years from now, you'll probably be able to find his name online.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. So to me, this illustrates the problem of zero tolerance policies. I mean, when we have those, we don't look at the circumstances surrounding the case, and we don't look at the fact of what is age appropriate, and what will somebody of this age even recognize? You can tell me this six-year-old boy is going to recognize what sexual harassment is. He probably, just like most six-year-old boys, had a crush on this girl in class and decided to kiss her hand. Did that do great damage to this girl? I mean, really?
Well, I think the bigger issue is, who do you blame? Who would you blame for making this decision to classify him and suspend him based on being a sexual harasser?
Well, the school district.
Yeah, but who in the school district? Is it
whoever
the teacher?
Whoever made the decision.
Is it the teacher? Is it the school board? Is it the principal? I mean, but here's the problem that I think we overlook when we think about how ridiculous these things are. If it was left up to one person to say, is this right or wrong? Well, that person then has to question whether or not they are complying with the school policy, which states, if it uses the term zero tolerance, then that's really not subject to interpretation, is it?
Right.
And I see where you're going with the zero tolerance not being a good concept that we can fully incorporate, because it kind of smacks of the problem that we always have with mandatory minimum sentences, or, you know, mandatory prosecutions of cases that don't necessarily warrant it, but because there is a higher up somewhere in the chain that has decided this is going to be our policy. Here's the problem. There is intrinsically nothing wrong with the school board taking a position that they will not tolerate sexual harassment. That then goes down the chain, down the ladder, so to speak, and there is instruction given to teachers for how to deal with these situations. A teacher then has to make the call that says, okay, does this or does this not fit within our zero tolerance policy? And because of the fact that we have such a fear of repercussions for making the wrong decision, I think that people tend to err on the side of, well, okay, zero tolerance means zero tolerance. So, you know, it's part of the problem when we have a hypersensitive view on something in society, and that we can't account for individual characteristics of a particular incident. So if the teacher had the authority, him or her, to decide on the spot that this does or doesn't fit within it, you know. So I'm being a little bit facetious here.
It's the people who wrote the policy,
right?
It should be.
I suppose.
And when it comes to this, though, Kirk, I mean, the you're right about that. I mean, if they don't have discretion and the teachers are just following what they're supposed to do, I'm not necessarily blaming the teachers for this. I'm saying that the overall policy on this is wrong. And when we get into this reactionary mode, you know, it's the same when it comes to things like mandatory minimum sentences, right? Where legislators get an idea and they say, well, this is going to be a mandatory minimum sentence of at least 25 years in prison. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. The judge doesn't have any discretion to do anything else. We're writing this policy in. But then you look at the individual facts of a particular case, and all the facts may fit the crime, it doesn't justify a 25-year mandatory minimum sentence. So this is the problem when we take out discretion and we try to use...
What do you think about labeling this as misconduct?
Well, I don't think it is misconduct.
Well, let's... Hold on a second. I mean, there is a chance that this young lady did not want this affection or attention. And you also have to remember how six-year-olds respond to this type of thing. She could be made fun of. There could be ridiculing going on. They could do the old, Sam and Susie sitting in a tree, you know, that kind of thing. And I think that...
Like normal things that kids get?
Normal things, but it's also something that, let's not forget that an educational environment, albeit first grade, is still an educational environment.
But
and the purpose.
They're six years old.
I get that. But you know, when you start educating a person about what's appropriate behavior and what's not.
Okay, I'm all with you. Let's educate them. But
let's,
you put something formally in their file.
Let's say
that
you're 20
harassment?
Years old and you're at the bank and you are depositing a check and the clerk hands you your receipt and you grab her hand and kiss it. I mean, that's not appropriate, right?
That's not
appropriate. You see a problem with that?
But there's a big difference. You're 20.
I know that, but you're starting to teach kids at an early age what's appropriate and what's not.
Then let's sit down with
the boy. It is misconduct. Can we agree on that?
Well, I think it was... If the girl obviously didn't want it, it was wrong. There's no question about that.
That's how I define misconduct. It's wrong.
Right. Okay, it's wrong. But... Let's sit the boy down and let's talk to him about it. I mean, rather than...
Don't you think that happened?
I don't know. I don't think it did. I mean, you know, I can only assume that they were going into the knee-jerk reaction of saying, well, we need to take this boy down to the principal's office. We need to put a sexual harassment complaint in his file or misconduct, as it allegedly turned out to be. And that's that. Rather than educating people about what is it isn't okay, and it's not okay to kiss somebody's hand if they don't want it, that's not okay. And we know that, and little boys ought to be taught that. But for God's sake, I mean, you remember the case we talked about in Wisconsin where the boy was charged as with a sex crime?
Yeah.
For playing doctor with a girl? Now, That involved private parts, right?
Right.
And so that was different. But even in that situation, there was such outrage to that.
But don't you think that the rules of society are just as important? I mean, obviously he committed no crime, I wouldn't say. But in terms of... instructing and guiding a six-year-old in terms of what is and what isn't acceptable just based on the rules of society. I mean, what's going to get you further in life? You know, this is something that if you have this impulse, you have this desire, albeit something as simple as kissing a hand or kissing a cheek, you know, you need to know that this is not something that is going to help you get where you want to go in life.
Well, that's true, but they took the approach, and I think it was too harsh, to suspend the boy from school for this. And when you're suspending him, at least according to his mother, and by the way, the mother...
Well, you can get suspended for not doing your homework.
Well, I mean, sure, but the mother of the girl who was kissed on her hand... is defending the school. And she's saying essentially that the boy has tried to kiss her over and over again before.
See?
And that the school is protecting her daughter.
Yeah, I can see that.
They're protecting her daughter.
I mean, I know he didn't do anything that bad, but you got to remember, this is a six-year-old girl too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and in terms of what happens in that school environment and the way that kids talk and the way kids, like I said before, make fun of each other or whatever the case may be, if this is unwarranted, and that it's disrupting the purpose of having that six-year-old boy and that six-year-old girl in school.
So why then do you think this story, if what the school did was okay, got such broad attention? I mean, why did society?
I'll tell you why. It's because the two words. First, sexual, and second, harassment, because it's fitting it into a category.
And six-year-old, right?
Yeah, and six-year-old, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we're fitting it into a category that we don't typically think of as that. But I have no problem with the school taking some form of action and calling this misconduct, because it would potentially interfere with the purpose of having that educational environment where we want people to feel safe. We want people to feel that they're not under pressure for any of these kinds of things. And this poor girl down. She's part of the headline too.
Kirk, I feel like in these situations and when I'm a parent eventually, I'll probably sit down and I'm hoping that I'll be one of those parents that will say, you know, little Johnny, if you get in trouble at school, you know, you have to accept the consequences, and because you probably did something wrong. On the other hand, if it was a situation like this and my kid came home to me and said, I just got suspended, Dad, from school. What'd you get suspended for? Well, I kissed Susie on the hand.
Yeah,
and I was suspended.
You'd go and talk to the school and you'd say, what the heck is going on here?
But wouldn't you?
Absolutely. But the point is, there would be a dialogue, and there was here, okay? And they took action that was probably ultimately appropriate. You know, we can't say. But I'm reminded of the beaver. Who, you know, leave it to Beaver.
Yeah.
You remember the episode where he comes home and talks to Ward when he was being harassed by a bully in school? And Ward, of course, gets the idea that he's going to go have a talk with the young boy's father. He comes back with a black eye. You know, why am I reminded of this? Because I can see you doing that when you have your child.
Not. Oh, stop it. All right. We'll be back. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. Let's talk about cows.
Let's talk about cows. There was some...
Isn't there a song like that? Let's talk about cows.
I think that's a different one, but, you know, maybe in some alternate universe, there's something like that.
In Kirk's world.
There are incidents of, and this is really disturbing video if you've seen it, of sick and injured.
I have seen it, yeah.
Yeah, sick and injured dairy cows, and they're being slapped and poked and forced to their feet with all this machinery. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported on this, and one of them included suspending a disabled cow in the air with a mechanical lift. I mean, it clearly appears to be, on the face of it, to be animal cruelty or abuse to these animals.
This is, by the way, a dairy farm in
Brown County.
In Brown County, Greenleaf specifically. And this is a large-scale farm. I believe they're over, 4,500?
It says the Wheezy Brothers.
Wheezy Brothers, right. I think it's 4,500 cows, if I'm not mistaken. And they are one of the suppliers of cheese for DiGiorno Pizza.
Right.
Or were. They were.
And they have fired two of their employees for suspected animal abuse. They say they don't tolerate any of this. The Brown County DA's office is now they've declined comment, but they're saying through a spokeswoman that the sheriff's department is still investigating the case and hadn't sent a referral over to the Brown County DA's office yet. State Senator Tim Carpenter issued a statement calling on Lassay to investigate and prosecute the workers who were shown harming the cattle. Some dairy farmers are saying, yes, this is wrong, but there may be some explanations as to why certain things were done here.
Go ahead.
Kicking a down cow using a stick. In some cases they have to get the animals back on their feet.
Let's play. This is going to be hard. Trust me. I'm going to try to play devil's advocate here, and I'm going to fail. I'm sure. I watched the videos, and what I could gather from it, and this is just for the sake of discussion. Nobody think out there that I'm an animal hater. I love animals. I really do.
Right.
But it did appear that what the workers were trying to do was moving cows that wouldn't move under their own power, so to speak.
Right.
And that's wrong. You know, you shouldn't use a crane or whatever, you know, a forklift, a stick. But, you know, there is this thing that they make that you wouldn't use on people, but they manufacture it. It's called a cattle prod. And it delivers an electric shock to cattle to get them to move.
I'm not
saying that's right, and I couldn't do it. I couldn't work at one of these places because I happen to believe that we should treat animals like living beings, like anything else that's a living being, and have respect for that. And this is an animal that feels pain and can be mistreated. And although it is an animal that is able to withstand the cold climates, unlike humans, we shouldn't put them in situations where they are suffering.
And whether this actually gets charged out as animal abuse is another issue, because it may be inappropriate, it may be wrong, but who knows what the investigation is going to lead to. Now, I think the video is pretty shocking and looks pretty bad. But let's just take this to its logical extreme, okay? I mean, as you point out, cattle prods are used. Okay, and there are all sorts of other techniques that are used. I mean, if you've seen any of the documentaries on how your food is made how animals are treated, it's a horrible thing. And most people would feel repulsed by it. Now, I fully admit that when I go to the grocery store, and I admit that it's a terrible thing. I don't think about it. I don't think about how that meat got there. And I eat meat. Okay, I'm not a vegan. I'm not a vegetarian. I eat meat. But I admit that I probably wouldn't want to see how my food gets made.
So you probably don't have a problem with the mixed substance that is in hamburgers, chicken, whatever.
The more I see, the more I find myself going out to try to buy things that are, you know, maybe more expensive, but I can sleep at night.
You know,
better.
If more people did, then it wouldn't be more expensive. If more people went to local farms, not this local farm, but another local farm, where they treat the animals humanely and they make the meat better for you as a human being, we'd all be better off.
What about this though? In terms of animal cruelty, let's think about the chickens, right? We've got documentary evidence of this on television. Okay, I'm going to sound like a member of PETA. I'm not, but this is what happened.
That explains why you're nude right now.
Right. I was wondering about that. Yeah, the chickens that are sitting there in some of these farms have almost no room, and they grow them to be so big that they, in many cases, they can't move. Okay, Many people would consider that to be animal cruelty, yet it goes on all over the country and all over the world. In these conditions where these chickens and these animals, and not just chickens, but, you know, cattle and all sorts of animals are there, those are almost never charged out as animal abuse because they're part and parcel of how we get more food. We need to get more food. We need to produce more food. And so in some circumstances, some of these large, and I'm not saying like your typical farm, but some of these bigger factory farms, right, might treat animals in ways that most of us would not like.
Right.
And if we knew how they were treated,
and again,
we wouldn't like that.
You know,
it's kind of
I
like
know.
How seeing how sausage is made, right? We don't like
oh,
it.
Oh, right, right. Like when Teddy Roosevelt threw his breakfast out the window, you know, when he was reading The Jungle by Upton Sinclair. But, you know, again, I think that there is something that we need to understand, and we can blame ourselves for this as a society, that there are practices on farms and throughout society, as a matter of fact, that we tolerate because we just don't think of animals as having the same sort of status as human beings. And it's true. You know, how do you make a horse go faster when you're riding it? Well, you know, you see it during the horse races, and they whip it, right? How do you kill a chicken if you're going to eat it? Well, you chop its head off.
Right.
You know, and that's just how it's done.
And that's how it
should be done
all over the place.
Right.
Yeah. But
how do you shoot a deer? You shoot it.
Right. And that's part of the problem is we don't see how our food is made. And that's part of the problem. And I respect hunters. I respect conservationists. I think that they do a benefit to society.
Absolutely.
But I would be the first to admit that in terms of killing an animal,
I'd
have a hard time doing it because
I got a freezer full of venison.
Right. I know. And I eat all the time. So it's hypocritical. But what I'm saying about this is part of the problem is when we see things on television like Bambi and like, you know, Winnie the Pooh and like all these other cartoons that depict animals as
I don't really think of Winnie the Pooh as an animal, though. I mean, he's more like a stuffed animal.
I'm thinking in terms of the way that we depict animals, even on those. What are those chicken commercials where they say eat more chicken?
Yeah.
They depict the cows as these cows that can talk and they're happy.
They're diverting the attention of the
and they don't actually depict the real way.
What about I can see certain animals that I would actually prefer to be killed. For example, Barney the dinosaur. That would be awesome. No, I'm sorry.
That's so terrible. I'm just
being silly.
Sacrilegious.
I know.
What you're saying right here.
But seriously, you're absolutely right that, you know, this is something that I hope can be used as an opportunity to educate the public. And an organization sent an undercover worker in, which farms should be aware this happens. This is not the first time. And took a video legally, which you can do in Wisconsin. We're a one-party consent state, meaning that you can, as long as you are present during the recording of an incident, others do not need to be aware that you're doing that. And that's legal. In some states, that's not. But in our state, it is. And this was a perfectly legitimate method of capturing evidence that the general public doesn't know about. It also makes you wonder about, if we're talking about 4,500 cows, there are a lot of workers associated with that. These are people that arrive at work in the morning, go home at night, or even with a large-scale dairy operation like that, they might be showing up at night and leaving in the morning for how many cows we're talking about here. And, you know, this is part of the groupthink process. When certain activities are observed and no one says anything about it.
And the question, though, becomes what do we do about this at this point? We expose it. And we have – but there are many people who push for greater laws and stricter laws when it comes to animal cruelty. Okay. Now, we do have laws on the books in Wisconsin that could be charged out. But oftentimes they're not charged out for one reason or another. And some of that might be societal because most people recognize, okay, animals are not humans and we know they're not humans and they do have a different status than humans do. You know, we eat many of them. We put them on our table for food. We don't do that with humans, at least most people don't.
Well, I don't. Yeah.
Yes, most people don't. And so they do have a different status. But how do we go forward with this? Is this an issue where you think that more prosecutions should come as part of animal abuse and animal cruelty, or do you think it's about right or should be lessened?
Well, I think these people do need to be prosecuted.
You do?
I do. And because this is one of those examples where deterrence makes sense, because if this is something that occurred because it was tolerated or people saw this and didn't do anything to stop it, that's a problem. And the public needs to be on notice that you have a duty to stop something when you know it's wrong. And you can't just look the other way. You can't just say, ah, this is how things work, and I feel wrong about it, but at least I'm not doing it, or whatever. You have to tell yourself to make it seem like it's okay in your own mind. So I think it's a valuable situation to prosecute these individuals.
All right. Well, this has been another edition of Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Remember, you can join us every week right here on 1330 WHBL from 8 to 9 on Saturdays. We'll see you next week. Have a wonderful weekend.